traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
Okay, Genna Lozovsky of Sandclass Capital Management. Thank you so much for joining the Contrarian Investor Podcast today. We are here to discuss your specialty of emerging market distressed debt. Now, this is an asset class that we don't hear all that much about typically. And when we do, it's usually that this is very risky and that a lot of these bonds often collapse and investors lose all their capital. But you have had a very successful career in investing in this asset class, and you have some views on it. And so I wanted to have you come on the podcast to talk through some of this. So talk to me just in general terms of emerging market credit. Why are you attracted to this?
Sure. Well, Nathaniel, thank you very much for hosting the podcast and for inviting us to participate. We've been doing emerging markets, or I've been doing emerging markets for pretty much my entire career. And we've been through a few cycles. We had the early cycle in the 90s, which was premised on the integration of a couple billion people actually into the global economy, Russia, India, China being kind of the three key markets we focused more on the Russian market, just because for some kind of local reasons, if you will. But overall, the 90s and early 2000s were a period where the integration of emerging markets into the global economy created these one-off wealth effects for many emerging market economies. Nominal GDP in dollar terms in Russia, I think from the mid-90s to the mid-2000s, was up 7-8 times in dollar terms. So yeah, this enormous wealth effect. Then, as they entered the world market, more and more of them were able to tap, if you will, external source of financing for growth and development. And anytime someone, everywhere, always in history, whenever someone levers themselves in order to fund growth and development, it works for some and doesn't work for all. For those to whom it doesn't work, there's still always a path forward that allows them to kind of wipe the slate and start again after some reorganization, if you will, of the relationship between the borrower and the issuers, the borrower and the lender, sorry. And emerging markets got into those troubles in 97, 98, during the, especially when you had the Asian flu in Russia. And of course, there was a second round in the late 2000s during the global financial crisis. And lastly, we've had one kind of in this COVID environment. And then those are kind of the systematic opportunity sets. And then, of course, idiosyncratically, there have been events along the way. We had a revolution in Ukraine in 2014, which triggered a debt crisis. We had the Eurozone crisis with Greece, for example, which was a relic, if you will, of the 2008 global financial crisis. But in many of these cases, it's all kind of, if you use this kind of Austrian economic model of malinvestment over time, people levering themselves up, and that over time you have a growth spurt, which creates malinvestment. Sooner or later, people see that. You have capital outflows, which further, of course, depreciates domestic prices, and you have a proper kind of debt bust. So that's the story. What makes emerging markets interesting from our point of view in this process is, if you think about emerging markets as a whole, kind of a misnomer, of course, but if we were to think about it this way, basically it's a large group of dynamic economies which have a heterogeneous approach to exchange rates, fiscal policy, monetary policy. Many of them, and I should say importantly, for many of them, they have complicated political economies, which drive many of these features. Those are, for most Western investors, can be somewhat opaque and confusing and complicated. Mm-hmm. And specifically because of that confusion and complication, oftentimes you get mispricings of those assets versus their potential recovery value. And in that, effectively lies our business.
Right. And you touch on it. There are, you know, I guess these touch points were points of crisis, in fact, in these economies. So, and then the more idiosyncratic specific things. But what is your entry point here? Your mandate, it sounds like, it is completely global, right? And
but like global emerging markets, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And but what is your, so then what is your, what do you look for in terms of an entry point?
Well, we do sovereigns and corporates. Okay. So typically with respect to either a sovereign or corporate, it's typically when there's been some kind of event that's created an event shock of some kind that oftentimes, especially when we speak about sovereigns, triggers a wave of capital outflows. And usually in those situations, we want to be liquidity providers to those people, obviously at prices that we think significantly underestimate the recovery potential of those assets. So maybe an example, an idiosyncratic example that I mentioned earlier in the call, Ukraine. During the Ukraine crisis, and let's remember what it was exactly, you had a revolution which triggered a which led to the flight of the former president, a break in the fixed exchange rate, the local currency, the hryvnia devalued from around 8 from memory to about 25, pretty much overnight, and you had the loss of an enormous part of Ukraine's territory due to a conflict with Russia or Russian proxies, which much of which was its industrial heartland. So that kind of economic crisis and balance of payments crisis came together to result in investors fleeing the country. And when I say investors fleeing the country, I mean people selling sovereign credit, people selling corporate credit, people selling quasi-sovereign credit. In that specific crisis, we put most of our risk to work looking at corporates on a very kind of simple premise, which is who knows, we are pretty confident Ukraine is going to survive as a country. Although I should say at the time, people were talking about the Russian tanks going to making it to Kiev. But regardless whether that happened or not, these corporates need to live, and Ukraine will need these corporates. One of them was the largest metals and mining producer in the country, represented roughly 89% of GDP. Another was the largest electricity generator in the country. These are services that aren't going to go away. And when we invested, their bonds traded between 25 and 35 cents, which was a fraction, if you will. Many of them traded at par even 6 to 9 months ago. And we thought that was an enormous opportunity, and that's where we allocated our risk.
Cool. And now more recently, Argentina. Now this is a country who's been in and out of the creditors' offices, you know, with the IMF and et cetera for quite a while. I remember the default in the early 2000s, I think. And, you know, there was the election last year. So talk me through there and how that emerged.
Sure. Argentina experienced a very sharp real effective exchange rate shock after it had been going through an unpleasant period of adjustment of its exchange rate prior to the 2019 election, which was supported by a big IMF rescue package. The hope among many local investors, was that the center-right government run by Mauricio Macri would win the election and continue to steer the country on a center-right direction. In the summer of 19, when it became evident after a kind of preliminary, it's called the PASO in Argentina, they have a quirky electoral system, when it became clear that Macri would not be the next president, and the next president would be the center-left government run by Fernandez, you just had a massive capital flight from the country, which put enormous pressure on the exchange rate, and Argentina faced a very sharp devaluation. As a result of that, because Argentina has a lot of debt has a lot of debt denominated in FX, all of a sudden debt looked from being kind of on the edge of being sustainable to being, certainly from a liquidity point of view, there's no way Argentina would access markets under those conditions. And as a result, Argentina proceeded shortly after the inauguration of the president to work on a restructuring of creditors. That coincided shortly thereafter with, of course, the coronavirus crisis, which further exacerbated the challenge. Argentina has gone through that through coronavirus in a very painful way, certainly economically. Frankly, the country was an early adopter of lockdown, and Buenos Aires remains in lockdown, and we're in August at this point. So the fiscal numbers are terrible. Going through this crisis, of course, importantly, Argentina has worked out that they need to complete their debt operation so that sooner or later when coronavirus ends, they can focus on the next big problem, which is rebooting the economy, given, you know, frankly, the limited resources that it has. We got involved in Argentina before coronavirus in a, I would say, meaningful but not necessarily extravagant way, expecting a benign recovery, if you will, for creditors. When I say our involvement there, it crossed, so we were involved in sovereign debt, in provincial debt. So the provinces in Argentina have issued New York law U.S. dollar paper, and so they're also debtors, if you will, although indeed much of their revenue comes from co-participation agreement with the federal. And then Argentine corporates, which are frankly not very levered because they haven't really had access to the borrowing. So we had a meaningful, but I would say not necessarily extravagant position in Argentina going into coronavirus. And then during the coronavirus crisis, you know, Argentina debt traded extremely poorly. Part of that was, I would say, just the overall beta component, meaning markets all traded off, and so did Argentina. It's certainly not immune from broader market forces. And then part of that was a feeling that Argentina had taken its relationship with its external creditors, had taken a sharp U-turn for the worse. And certainly the posture of the government changed during coronavirus from one of seeking a quick and friendly deal to one of we're going to get in the trenches and really try to hardball. We took a view that Argentina's hardball strategy would ultimately fail. Argentina has no choice but to restructure its debt with its external creditors in advance of its upcoming IMF negotiations and ultimately. So we used the opportunity to practically double our position, actually, in Argentina. And frankly, that bet has worked out. We had an initial offer from Argentina that would have paid creditors 34, 35 cents. That was back in March. That Argentina curiously went to the market with that proposal without seeking any kind of creditor group consent. The proposal fell sharply on its face. Argentina then quickly did a U-turn and then engaged with creditors. And after a series of negotiations, we have the deal that's been finally announced and for which will be voted on. I think with a high degree of certainty, almost all bonds owned by external creditors will be tendered in and exchanged.
And so you're confident, I would assume, that the country can now continue making its payments on these.
Well, the terms of the restructuring are as a non-cash restructuring. So Argentina is basically swapping existing claims for new claims. There's no cash being paid out to creditors. The repayment profile is not particularly burdensome to Argentina. The coupon rates are extremely low. Maturities are long extended. There's one modest hump in 26-27 or so. But it's generally a very benign repayment runway. So we think that Argentina should not necessarily struggle with the repayment. Now, you asked the question, you're confident that Argentina will be able to repay. That's a difficult question. Default isn't always and everywhere, and repayment is always and everywhere, a political question first and foremost. Okay. So when we say Argentina's debt was unsustainable, what we really mean by that is given the political constraints that the country faces, or even reasonable political constraints that the country faces, Argentina would struggle to repay. But, you know, we have to use some nasty, not necessarily role model examples from history, but some examples. The Romanians in the Soviet times had borrowed from external markets, and Ceausescu was committed to not defaulting. And, you know, the country starved for 10 years, but he did his best to stay current on Romania's external debt. That's not a choice we'd advise anyone, but I'm pointing out that ultimately it's a decision. Do you pay or do you not pay? And we have countries with very little debt that run into repayment problems because simply there's not the political will to make adjustments so that they can stay current. Mm-hmm. So if I just go back to your question, I would say, am I confident Argentina will be able to? It would require too much for Argentina to remain current. But as I said, always default and repayment isn't always and will be a political question.
Yeah.
If there's another economic shock, how much of that economic shock is Argentina going to try to impose on creditors versus imposing on itself through some element of fiscal austerity? And that's a question that is a future political economic call.
Sure. Okay. Well, that's really interesting. Now, these bonds and these credits, this is all dollar or you know, euro or Western currency denominated. You don't trade the local currency to the extent that there is any.
No, there's local. There's a local market. We're not involved in that. No.
Okay.
We're mostly involved in either New York or UK law.
Right. Oh, very interesting. So are there any other areas that you're now maybe looking to put money to work that we can talk about? Or
sure. So, you know, we've been invested. We mentioned Argentina as a big sovereign. And I want to emphasize, you know, we've just completed the sovereign. Well, we haven't completed yet. We're on the cusp of completing a sovereign restructuring. But now all the provinces are in the process of doing restructuring. So I think we'll be thinking about Argentina for the balance of the year. I'm not expecting any material corporate restructurings other than, you know, so outside of Argentina, we've been involved in other sovereigns during coronavirus, as a result of the coronavirus shock. We were very heavily involved in Ecuador after its bonds collapsed as a result of a combination of several things. One of them is coronavirus. A second explanatory variable is, of course, the oil price shock, which are disrupted their balance of payments. Unlike Argentina, Ecuador doesn't have its own currency. It's a U.S. dollar dominant economy. So that serves as a very hard constraint, if you will. You can't paper over problems. If the money doesn't come in, you can't, you have nothing to spend. So we were heavily involved in that restructuring, and we've since, that's gone very well for us. Ecuador announced a successful restructuring with its bondholders. We participated in that exchange to some extent. We severely reduced our positions there. We've also been heavily invested in some corporates, some of which we've known in the past. You know, some exciting opportunities are corporate redefaulters, where although I know it's a little bit counterintuitive, but sometimes there's just an objective hard constraint. Someone has to defaults twice in the span of a decade or something. And in many of these names, we just happen to know the issuer very well. We know the situation very well. And so we've gotten quite involved in a couple of corporate names that have defaulted again and are going through a restructuring process. Last time around, we had a very benign outcome for creditors, and we're expecting, frankly, a similarly benign outcome this time. Maybe a bit less benign than before, but a similarly benign outcome for creditors this time. And then, because we always like convexity in investment ideas, we've also been looking at select equity names. You know, it's always been a smaller facet of what we do, but it has been a part of what we do. One area that stands out that I have to mention is Greece, where we were very active in the sovereign restructuring in 2014-15 and kind of the slow path of, I would say, the reintegration of Greek external debt into the kind of overall Euro-denominated borrowing framework, which took many years and many policies by the ECB and some ironclad agreements between Greece and its European partners, which went to bonds, you know, over the course of many years, going from as low as 30 cents to way through par. But more recently, we've been involved in a number of Greek equity names. We are modestly optimistic about the Greek recovery story from coronavirus. We are extremely optimistic about where equity prices are versus such a path. And I should say the path for many of these Greek stories today, many of these Greek equities are priced as if Greece will go through a whole another round of another depression. And I think that's an extremely pessimistic outcome. And we think there's a lot of optionality for a little bit more on the edgy side, if I just add lastly, is we've started turning our attention to some ideas that are specifically coronavirus victims. And EM Airlines would be an example of that, of course, at least all airlines, but we do emerging markets. And some EM Airlines are an example of that offer extremely attractive, our kind of preliminary assessment, extremely attractive optionality in the event that we ever get back to a new normal, that at least in terms of air travel, more or less resembles the old normal. If that is what happens over the course of several years, the optionality in many of these names is just eye-popping.
Interesting. Yeah. And you mentioned Greece, and it's funny. I did have an emerging markets equities guy on earlier this year, very early in the year before any coronavirus. And he was very, very bullish on Greece. Yeah. A couple of banks and,
yeah,
but anyway, oh, that's really interesting. Okay. Okay. Again, Lazovsky, I want to ask you some more questions about your background and how you came to, this very interesting asset class, but
sure.
Let's first take a short break.
You are listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We're on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and other platforms where podcasts are found. Subscribe and supply an honest rating. We're on social media. Search for Contrarian Investor Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. You can find us on LinkedIn as well. Go to linkedin.com/contrarianpodcast. We want to hear from our listeners. Email your thoughts to feedback@contrarianpod.com. A repository of all podcast episodes and materials is available on our website, contrarianpod.com. Now, back to the program. Here's Mr. Baker.
Okay, again, Lazovsky, we are back here after the break. This is the segment of the show where we ask our guest about his background, how he came to this stage of his career, and things of that nature. So why don't you take it away and tell us how you got started in investing and how you came to start this fund and to where you find yourself now.
Sure, thanks. So basically, I started my career on Wall Street as most of us in the M&A group at Credit Suisse in the early 90s, just before emerging markets were taking off. By a fluke of luck, because I was born in the former Soviet Union, I grew up speaking Russian. So the transition to my career in emerging markets was simply one day Credit Suisse had a successful business in Russia, in Moscow. And my first step in EM was chance encounter with the head of the Moscow office at CS's offices. And he heard me speaking Russian and back then Russian speaking with some Wall Street experience was a rare thing to find. Today, obviously, it's not very rare. So that led me to come to Russia, and that kind of kicked off, if you will, my EM experience. And specifically our fund, after 2008, I teamed up with some guys from More Capital to start a firm called Slow Capital Management. We ran a global special situations fund, to which my silo of that, if you will, was just the emerging markets portion. And then in 2013, Michelle and I teamed up and launched Sandglass Capital Management, which was the idea being to kind of do it on our own and start this business to benefit from a different opportunity set. Then certainly our prior EM experience was about, and I touched on that a little bit earlier in the call. It's gone from being a kind of, you know, buy growth, or everyone's getting richer, to much more kind of asset selection and more kind of looking for real efficiencies and market dislocations.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. All right. Now, you mentioned earlier that the preference for dollar-denominated bonds or euro-denominated bonds, but the local currency ones present a massive opportunity in terms of the yield on these things. So sure. why don't you look at those at all?
To say that we don't look at them is not a bit strong. Yeah, but our participation in local currency paper in general has been somewhat limited. Mm-hmm. So the main reason for it is what I've described earlier as our investment thesis is premised on bottoms-up credit work, top-down macro credit work, some political economy discounting. Okay, local currency paper comes with another important feature, which is you have to kind of assess the monetary path, if you will, and the policy actions of the central bank. We are less convinced that we have a universally strong framework for that versus, say, others. And so that's kind of one reason is there's another dimension, if you will, in many cases that dimension is the only dominant dimension. So in some, we've in the past generally shied away from that. So that's one reason. So when you mention, you know, yields are very high, I would like to point out, certainly nominal yields are very high. But as you know, many of these economies run fewer and fewer EMs these days, but still many economies run high inflation. And so kind of in real terms, and then of course you have to worry about the exchange rate ultimately, you know, our investors, US dollars. And that's our kind of, that's our risk-free asset, if you were a currency numeraire. So in kind of in real terms, those yield, it's less obvious you have such a compelling yield story. Another important feature, of course, is typically local currency paper is local law paper. The importance of having a enforceable New York or UK law claim that can't be rewritten with the stroke of a pen by a legislature is, I think, very important. I'd hearken investors back to the Greek example, where Greece had, roughly from memory, 93% of Greece's debt in 2012 was Greek law, something like that, 93%. And the rest, and the other small amount of 7% was UK law. Come PSI, which was the Greek restructuring, the private sector involvement, in Greece's restructuring efforts, the entire Greek law debt stock was converted into new bonds at around 25 cents on the dollar. And the UK law paper held out and all got paid par at maturity. So I think it's an interesting example where if you basically, where 2 years prior to that, no one actually bothered, many people didn't bother to check whether their what their prospectus said, whether it was Greek law or UK law. But if you had, and you had the UK law bonds, you ended up getting par. And if you didn't, you ended up getting 25 cents. Mm. So it just shows you the importance of being able to have a proper and enforceable claim.
Yeah, I guess that will be huge. What kind of information do you look for, and how do you get information? It's not just like, you know, there's earnings calls and things like that, and so that must be a pretty tedious process, yeah.
Well, actually, no, there are earnings calls actually. Many of the corporate,
corporate, sure, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for corporates, and you know, most EMs that we, not certainly not all, but most EMs that we invest in provide regular reporting.
Okay.
There are obviously some question marks about the quality of their reporting, and some of them get in trouble. But many of them have been through at one time or another an IMF program and have been properly reporting standards for many EM. A lot of EM macro reporting has been standardized, if you will. No, there's definitely reporting and data available. I would question that. And then corporates, I mean, there are definitely earnings. There are definitely earnings calls. In general, I should just point out that most of the EM corporates that we're involved in are typically not, you know, a small dry cleaning chain in you know, somewhere in some corner of of India or of Kenya or something. These are typically big multi-billion-dollar corporates. Some of them are either government-owned or have government involvement. And they oftentimes are part of the economic infrastructure, if you will, of many of these countries. Yeah. So that's an important feature in handicapping the creditworthiness is this feature of kind of a moral hazard, stroke political economic support, TBTF, too big to fail, et cetera, et cetera. So I would just so add overall, no, there's definitely reporting and there's definitely information available. Now, is that a sufficient amount of information available? I strongly answer no. So one of the things that we do, besides following all the publicly available data, which is released by issuers, we also, of course, do a lot of on-the-ground research. So, for example, in Ukraine, we used to travel there 6, 7, 8 times a year. Back when we were heavily invested in Ukraine, in Russia and Kazakhstan, I spent too many cold winters there. And if you think Russia's cold, you haven't been to Kazakhstan. And more recently, of course, in Argentina, I think we made, before lockdown, I think in 4 months, I think I was there 4 times. I think I probably spent probably a month between August and Christmas in Argentina. So I think kind of on-the-ground visits is an important feature, if you will, of collection. You get local perspectives. You get to meet decision makers, policy makers, and others involved in the economy and the market to help form your shape and form your view of what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. Okay.
By the way, that doesn't mean locals are always right. In fact, my little rule of thumb is locals are always too bullish or too bearish. In the good times, they're too bullish, and in the bad times, they're too bearish.
Interesting.
It's been my experience.
Now, how long do you hold these positions for typically?
There isn't really a rule of thumb on this question. Ultimately, in a certain way, every day we have to assess. Formally speaking, every day we make an assessment: is the upside, you know, for this investment, risk adjusted, worth remaining long versus going down? Is our potential VIG still kind of attractive? That's something that we have to do in some respects on a daily basis. As a general, I'd say we are, our model, our investment fund's model, is to take, build a diverse book of risky bets rather than a highly concentrated, you know, geared book of low risk bets, and to try to lever them up. In general, so with that framework, you know, to the extent something is no longer sufficiently risky for us, which is a good outcome, means, you know, something's gone right. We bought it when it was risky, and then the right stuff happened, and it's no longer risky. That would typically be a point of divestiture, because we should be kind of using our balance sheet to stay and remain invested in things that are sufficient risk. Hmm. I'd say historically we've held things as short as a month, of course, but that'd be very uncommon. We've had investments that we've held for 3 or 4 years. There's no hard and fast rule. I would say, as a general matter, when we make an investment, we think about it on a 6 and 12 month forward basis, but generally on a 12 month forward basis. Mm-hmm. Generally, we think about it in a year's time, but what we need to know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right, Gena Lozovsky, thank you so much for joining us. Maybe in closing, I just tell our listeners where they can find out more about you. You do have a website.
We do have a website.
And what's the address?
Sandglasscapital.com.
Sandglasscapital.com.
I would encourage anyone who wants more information to click on the investor relations outreach on the website. As for regulatory reasons, we can't say too much about ourselves on the website, but we'd be happy to share more information for those interested in
speaking. Very good. Very good. All right, cool. I'll put that information in the show notes as well, just in case you missed it. And that will wrap up today's podcast. Thank you all for listening, and we look forward to speaking to you all again next time.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time. Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org, paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.